We are obliged to maintain growth, because if we don't, our societies will fall apart. Not just our economies, but what growth does is it provides a lubricant between rich and poor.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. What can nature teach us about our current economic collapse? Could society survive without endless planet-killing growth? We'll find out in this interview of scientist and author Thomas Homer Dixon by guest host KMO, creator of the Sea Realm podcast.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, KMO, and joining me is Thomas Homer Dixon. He holds the Center for International Governance and Innovation Chair of Global Systems at the Balsillie School of International Affairs in Waterloo, and is a professor in the Center for Environmental and Business in the Faculty of Environment, University of Waterloo. He is the author of three award-winning books, the most recent of which is The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. Thomas Homer Dixon, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's terrific to be with you.
You have provided a reading from your new book. It is called Carbon Shift, How the Twin Crises of Oil Depletion and Climate Change Will Define the Future. But first, I am interested in talking about economic matters. I keep coming back to the work of Buzz Holling, which you describe in your book, The Upside of Down. And there's one sentence that I would like to read, and the sentence is this. So, we're overextending the growth phase of our global adaptive cycle.
Well, okay, that's a good place to start. Now, your listeners have to realize that preceding that sentence was about 10 pages of spade work in which I sort of defined each of the concepts in that sentence and explained why each concept is important and how they work together. But let me walk through that very quickly for your listeners. First of all, a bit about Buzz Holling. He's a remarkable man. He's an ecologist, Canadian ecologist, now I think approaching 80 years old, still completely vigorous, full of life, and still making a terrific intellectual contribution. He pioneered the investigation of the cycles of adaptation that occur in ecological systems. He started by looking at the spruce forests in New Brunswick in Canada, went on to look at many other ecological systems. And to sort of compress a very long story, he discovered that you could describe the cycles of adaptation and development of ecological systems as occurring in a space, a three-dimensional space, an abstract space, characterized by three variables along each axis of the three-dimensional space. You can think of a cube. One variable is potential, one variable is connectedness, and one variable is resilience. So let's keep those three variables in mind, potential, connectedness, and resilience. By potential, he basically means the amount of information in a system or the capital available in a system. So if you're thinking of a forest, and he uses a forest as a sort of central example, as it's growing and becoming more mature over time, it builds its potential. It builds in particular the total biomass in the forest and the amount of genetic information in the forest, especially if the forest is becoming more diverse with different species. And so there's more information in total, genetic information, more capital, more biomass, in a sense, in that forest. So the potential is increasing. As the forest matures, it also becomes more connected. All the elements, the species of plants and animals, become very tightly interwoven with movements of energy and chemicals and elements back and forth between them, and on a daily basis, and then even on by seconds. So there are many different time frames operating. So that's the connectivity, and that tends to increase over time too. But then the third variable moves in an opposite direction. He discovered that as a forest reaches its most mature stage, it tends to become less resilient. So resilience actually declines, and by resilience, he means the ability to withstand a shock without falling apart, without catastrophic failure. So the forest actually becomes more and more vulnerable to a kind of collapse as it gets older, as its connectivity increases, and as its potential increases. One of the reasons is that because it's so connected, if there's, for instance, a fire or a disease, some kind of pathogen that infects the forest, because the forest is now so connected together, that shock, the fire, the disease will spread through the forest very quickly and produce a collapse of a larger portion of the ecosystem. But there's another thing that happens that's very interesting. As forests become mature, they tend to become very efficient in converting energy and water and the nutrients in the soil into biomass. And they actually start to eliminate redundancy within the forest ecosystem. So a good example would be nitrogen fixers. All ecosystems require a certain number of organisms called nitrogen fixers to take nitrogen out of the atmosphere and convert it into a form that can be used by plants and then and convert it into proteins in animals. Now, as a forest becomes more mature, the diversity of nitrogen fixers actually declines. Ones that aren't absolutely essential are eliminated from the mix of species that are nitrogen fixers, and the forest becomes more and more reliant on a relatively small number of nitrogen fixers. So it's losing resilience. It's becoming more efficient at converting energy, material, and nutrients into biomass, but it's actually becoming more brittle. It's losing resilience. That's the basic model. The hypothesis that Holling puts forward and the researchers who've worked with him, and it's now borne out by a lot of research, is that all complex adaptive systems, and these can include things like market economies, even societies, ecological systems like forests, tend to cycle in this three-dimensional space. They have a growth phase, which is the front loop of the cycle, as referred to in that sentence. They have a growth phase during which the forest or the economy or the society will become more connected, more complex, and will build its potential in terms of its information content and its capital. But over time, will start to lose resilience. At the top of that growth phase, the system becomes very brittle. With a forest, it becomes very vulnerable to disease or to a fire. And when there's a shock of that kind, the system actually collapses. It falls apart. And then there's a back phase of the adaptive cycle, or what they call the back loop, which involves the system reorganizing itself, recombining its components in new ways so that it can be adapted to the new environment that it's in. Now, here's the critical point, and this is really very powerful that comes out of this research, is that these researchers are suggesting that every highly adaptive system has to have a breakdown phase, what they call the omega phase in its cycle. And that breakdown, that loss of resilience, breakdown, crisis, and reorganization of the components of the system are essential to adaptation. This is what the great economist Joseph Schumpeter in the 20th century called creative destruction in market economies. He pointed out that the reason the market economies are so adaptive is that they allow for creative destruction. A company will be founded, it will grow over time. If it's well run, it will prosper. It'll become larger, grow in its potential, but over time it may lose resilience and may become badly adapted to a changing economic environment. It might go bankrupt eventually, and the human and financial capital of that company can be reorganized in the economy to provide for adaptation. And the overall process is one of really fast and effective adaptation for the economy as a whole. This is a radical idea. And just to conclude my summary of Holling's ideas and their implications. I think the larger story here, and it's one I try to develop in the book, is that our global socio-ecological economic system, and we've really now, humankind has created a tightly coupled, highly connected, high potential global socio-ecological economic system with trade links and movements of material and energy, and with human beings being as large an actor in ecological sense as nature itself on the planet. That system is probably close to the top of the growth phase of the cycle. And in fact, in many respects, we might have prevented through our management smaller breakdowns that could have allowed us to adapt, and now we're looking at the possibility of very large breakdowns because we've prevented smaller breakdowns in the past. we have lost resilience. And I think the story of this financial crisis that we're going through right now is exactly the kind of thing that Holling was talking about. It's exactly the kind of thing that I anticipated within my book, The Upside of Down. We have an extremely brittle global economy that now is generating cascading failures that are affecting literally billions of people around the planet.
I'd like to read one other sentence, and this is from the previous page. And it is this: the longer people sustain a social, economic, or ecological system in its growth phase, the sharper, harder, and more destructive its ultimate breakdown will be. And it seems that the promise of any politician is that he will extend the growth phase of the adaptive cycle at least out through the end of his administration, and thereby not be around when the eventual collapse comes. Now, they don't admit that a collapse is inevitable. The adaptive growth cycle model is not something that is, you know, incorporated into the presentation of where they think we're going. We are sold a message of continual economic growth that will go on indefinitely. And it seems to me that there are a lot of people who are very hopeful right now that the Obama administration will manage to somehow extend the growth phase of our adaptive cycle for another 4 or 8 years and thereby make the eventual crash all that much worse. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that specific application of the general topic we've been discussing.
Well, you've got it exactly right. We ask our leaders, whether they are business leaders, corporate leaders, political leaders, basically to keep things the way they are on the current trajectory. And the current trajectory has been growth and increase in connectivity and complexity. And we want them to keep us on that trajectory. And the implication, if Holling and these other theorists are correct, is that all that's going to do is make the eventual crisis that much worse. Now, you can tell a story about the current economic crisis in exactly these terms. We would have been a lot better off if policymakers, bankers hadn't manipulated the economic incentives and the economic conditions to allow for the creation of these enormous equity bubbles over the last couple of decades. And I can remember a very prescient cover on The Economist, I think it was back in the mid-1990s, and it was showed a picture of a trader, probably Wall Street or something like that, falling out of a skyscraper, you know, obviously having thrown himself out because of a financial crisis. And the headline across the front of the Economist was, "Crash, damn it." And what The Economist editors were arguing is that we'd be a lot better off if there were small breakdowns in the system fairly regularly, which would mean small economic crashes, rather than trying to manipulate the system in such ways by reducing interest rates and covering people's economic bets, allowing people to build up enormous debts, by manipulating the system in various ways so that these small crises don't occur. In terms of an ecological system like a forest, the parallel is really quite extraordinary. What you want in a forest is smaller, more regular shocks, say fires, that don't wipe out large sections of the forest, but open up space for adaptivity that allow light in, that clear the land, that allow for change of various kinds, the introduction of new species, rearrangement of relations among species. What you don't want to do is prevent forest fires over long periods of time, because then you get an accumulation of an enormous amount of biomass that's extremely flammable. And when you do have a fire, it's an enormous fire, it's extremely hot. And as Holling points out, it's so hot that it destroys the seeds that will allow for the regermination of a forest subsequently. So it actually destroys the potential for creativity and adaptation. And in many respects, that's what we ask. In asking our politicians and leaders to keep things as they are, to maintain growth indefinitely, to allow the front loop of the growth cycle, of the adaptive cycle, to be extended indefinitely, we're actually increasing the probability that we're going to have a crisis that's so large eventually that we won't be able to adapt. We won't be able to respond creatively. That's a pathological outcome of the adaptive cycle. And I think, again, Holling is very insightful about this.
Green 960 AM, Progressive Radio, the heart of San Francisco.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, KMO, and I'm joined by Thomas Homer Dixon. He is the author of several books, including the award-winning The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. And we have been talking about growth phases and adaptive cycles and how the extending of the growth phase of an adaptive cycle makes the eventual correction all that much more severe and jarring. And I would like to talk a bit about employment and the what you call in your book the growth imperative, and how that relates to employment and how that relates to the money supply and technology. And again, this is a very large question, and it will require a long answer, so I will stop talking and let you approach that from whichever angle you think is most effective.
That's a question that, of course, is central to our current crisis, but it's one that doesn't get asked, and I find that somewhat discouraging. I think it will get asked more as time goes on, but there are some actually very deep contradictions, say, within our current economic system. To put the argument in its shortest form, it's that we are obliged to maintain growth, because if we don't, our societies will fall apart, not just our economies, but what growth does is it provides a lubricant between rich and poor, and it allows for some semblance of social stability, because we haven't dealt with the underlying problems of inequity, of disparities between rich and poor, and we cope with them over long periods of time by generating economic growth that allows for some trickle down and expands the overall pie so that everybody can feel happy enough that they don't revolt against the system. As soon as growth stops, you have the prospect of a zero-sum competition between rich and poor. Now, we learned a very tough lesson in the 1930s that I think has penetrated deeply into our culture, and especially the culture of economists and economic policymakers. And that lesson is that a failure of demand, a failure of consumption in an economy can be catastrophic. A deflationary cycle can be catastrophic because it sends unemployment skyrocketing. And when you have very high unemployment, especially a rapid rise of unemployment following a period when the economy was doing reasonably well, you can get political radicalization, and you can get the development of social pathologies such as national socialism. And we saw the consequences of that. It cost 50 million lives and produced the Holocaust. And the policy response, one of the most important policy responses to that social disaster, was Keynesian economics, basically an economic system or theory that allows for the perpetuation of growth indefinitely. Here's the reason, the underlying problem. Capitalist market economies are extraordinarily adaptive, and they are adaptive in large part because they generate constant technological change. Firms compete with each other to reduce their costs so they can reduce the prices of the goods and services that they sell and capture more market share. One of the principal ways that they can reduce their costs is by increasing the productivity of capital, the machinery that they use, producing more widgets essentially per unit of labor. But one of the results is that, especially when it comes to labor, if you increase the productivity, you don't need as much of it. So there is a constant process of displacement, technological displacement of labor in our economies. Quite understandable, quite natural. There's no malign intent here on the part of companies. They're just doing what they have to do to survive. They need to increase the productivity of capital and labor, and in the process, they use fewer and fewer people to produce the same stream of goods. Now, those people who are disemployed by technological change have to be absorbed somehow if you're not going to have the development of a potentially easily radicalized group of people within a society who are unemployed or underemployed. And the way we've learned how to do that, what Keynes basically showed us, was we've learned mechanisms for maintaining economic growth to absorb that technologically displaced labor, especially by maintaining consumption. We have to maintain consumption. So the whole point of economic growth is to keep the expansion of the economy sufficient to absorb workers who would otherwise be unemployed, especially by technological change. Now, the figures are really quite astonishing. On an annual basis in the United States, the American economy needs about 3% growth in real terms simply to prevent unemployment from rising. Now, that's partly because the population is growing and there's immigration, but a very significant portion of that 3% goes towards absorbing unemployment that's created by technological change. So we're hooked on growth. If we don't maintain growth, we're going to have steadily expanding unemployment in our economy, and that will have really disastrous social consequences. We've learned, I think, over time, partly because of the lessons of the Depression, and then the Second World War that followed, that growth equals peace. And I think even going farther back in history, we've learned the lesson, even drawn from, say, the Enlightenment, and perhaps even farther back to the notions of progress that developed in the Renaissance, that growth equals freedom. Now, that's a very powerful cultural combination. Growth equals peace, and growth equals freedom. And it's very difficult for anybody to challenge the assumption that growth is a good thing. Of course, on the other side of this equation, we have a global ecosystem that's increasingly showing the consequences of this perpetual growth. We have a world climate that is changing because of the enormous output of waste from the global economy. The World Bank anticipates that the global economy will grow at 3% a year, more or less indefinitely into the future. Obviously, that's not going to happen for the next couple of years because of the economic crisis, but that's its anticipated target growth rate. Well, that produces a doubling time of around 20 years. Every 20 years, the global economy will double every 20 to 25 years in real terms, in terms of its real economic output. We're already at a $70 trillion global economy. If we go out 40 or 50 years into the future with a 3% growth rate, doubling every 20 to 25 years, that means we will quadruple the size of the global economy by the time my children are my age, from $70 trillion to pretty close to $300 trillion. That's not going to happen. We have a global environment that's already suffering the consequences, the really dramatic consequences in terms of its incapacity to absorb the waste from our economic output. We have a resource system that's under stress, particularly in terms of energy production and the ability to find the energy we need to drive our global economy. Even at $70 trillion, it's simply inconceivable that an economy of $280 trillion is going to be sustainable within the finite limits of this planet. So we face a really absolutely inescapable contradiction, in a sense, between the underlying need for growth to maintain social stability on one hand and the imperatives of our global ecology on the other. And nobody's really talking about this, but we need to because it's probably the central crisis of this century.
Well, that is a frustrating place to have to end, but I realize that you have a meeting starting in less than 10 minutes. Well, Thomas Homer Dixon, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the program, and I would very much like to invite you back to continue this conversation, and I'm sure that the audience would like to have you back as well.
Well, KMO, it has been a delight, as usual. I really enjoy these conversations, and your questions are always right to the point and really take us places that I rarely get taken in my interviews. So thanks very much. It's been terrific.
My thanks to Thomas Homer Dixon and guest host KMO. Check out his Sea Realm podcast at C-Realm. Find this interview and many more free MP3 downloads on the state of our world at our website, ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for listening. Radio EcoShock on Green 960 AM San Francisco.